ever leave radio. Radio never leaves you, I don't think. And funnily enough, I think if I had cried, it might have been better. This is the moment you've got to do, verbally, what Mo's just done physically.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. John Inverdale.
My dad was a great raconteur, he really was, and he loved words. And interestingly, when I went to school, I think the teacher I was drawn to most, apart from the sporting people, was my English teacher, who obviously had a great love of words. So I got involved in my school newspaper. I kind of always, from a very early age, had it in my head that I'd like to work with words, not really thinking about broadcasting. But I do recall a guy called Alan Gibson, who was one of the very first voices on Test Match Special, who was a mate of my dad's, coming round to dinner one night and talking about an Ashes tour that he'd been on, which seemed to me like one almighty jolly. That, you know, if he wasn't watching cricket, he was lying on the beach. And I was about, I think I was 13 at the time, and I don't think it immediately said, I want to do that. But I think a residual bit of that conversation always lodged in the back of my mind, and I thought, actually, that might not be a bad way to make a living. My dad was in the Royal Navy and we moved around an awful lot, which I think is great in one respect because it means you get lots of experiences and go to lots of different places. On the other hand, it means you're a little bit rootless. One of the great things about having a sister older than you is that you, if you like, grow up a bit quicker than they do, because my sister was 10 years older than I was. So there were all these teenagers who were really cool guys, you know, cool girls. And I was just sort of tagging along at the back, certainly musically. You know, my sister and I had great battles about who was going to buy the latest Beatles single. But when I hear things like Good Vibrations or The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore or records like that, I am sitting by the pool in the Far East listening to the Top 20 rundown. But I do think actually that what it meant was that, especially because we were living abroad and didn't have a television, I suddenly got a love of radio, or maybe not suddenly, but I developed a love of radio from a very early age. I hear the sound of a gentle wind. Some of my abiding early memories are, I can see myself loving the interaction between me and this beast, whatever it is, on Radio Singapore or Radio Malaysia, coming at me and thinking, I love this. I love this relationship that slowly but surely I'm forming with this medium. I mean, this is, you know, 50-odd years on, and I may be talking complete nonsense, but I do think that in those early days, I tell you, actually, I do remember my best friend, his dad was crazy about fishing, and he tried to get me interested in fishing. I mean, I have to say, he failed dismally, not just because I couldn't catch anything, I just thought it was boring just sitting there, you know, hoping that you might get a bite. But he used to go fishing up country in the middle of the jungle in Malaysia, and I will never forget sitting on this riverbank, hoping to catch whatever you were hoping to catch in those days, and hearing for the very first time at the little kiosk where you used to get a cup of tea and a bacon roll or whatever it was, hearing for the very first time Rubber Soul played in its entirety, and just saying, never mind this fishing rubbish, what the hell is this? This sounds like the Beatles, I've got to go and hear this album. I wanted a girl, or should I say, she wanted me. My dad was an amateur boxing referee and he loved boxing, and I used to listen to Cassius Clay fights under the bedclothes, you know, and then Ali, obviously, and Simon Smith was the boxing commentator. What a voice he had. The resonance of his voice was fantastic. And then Des Lynam actually did the boxing commentary on the radio as well, and you knew that Des had a great voice as well, and he had the words and the ability to go up at the right moment and down at the right moment and just suck you in to the enormity of the event that he was covering.
People are on their feet at the ringside now, cheering Cooper. Hurt Clay in the first minute with a left hook, and has done well since. Left hooks and jabs, he's drawn blood from Clay's nose. He's hurt Clay, and Clay has been forced to complain.
I left school, I went to university, I did history degree, and then I thought I wanted to do a journalism postgraduate degree, which I did at Cardiff. I wanted to get a job on a local newspaper, but it was the worst possible time to do that. It was late 70s, Margaret Thatcher had just been elected to power, and one of her first battlegrounds was the print press and the printing industry. And it meant the local papers were closing right, left and centre. And I was writing to them ad nauseam, and they said, sorry, mate, you know, there is no possibility of us taking on people. We're letting people go. And then out of the blue, the Lincolnshire Echo came knocking via Northcliffe Newspapers, who owned papers from Aberdeen to Penzance. And they offered me a job at the Lincolnshire Echo, which is fantastic, thank you very much. But they offered to pay for my education in Cardiff on condition that when I went to Lincoln, I think I was paid 65% of my base salary to compensate for them having paid for me to go to Cardiff. Well, as economic decisions go, that was not one of the best I ever made. And it did mean that I lived in Lincoln in the most dreadful flat and I just had no spare money. I mean, I really, really didn't. But you also learn then as well, you know. I would sit in a local pub because to sort of stop the heating. Alone, this makes it sound pathetically, you know, like misery, but it's absolutely true. I didn't want to have a heating bill that was exponentially more than I could afford. So if you sat in a pub long enough and made that pint last long enough and read that book long enough, the evening used to drift on quite happily, and that's what you had to do, you know. Great fun, mind you. I mean, really, and a great learning curve as well. And I was there covering catsup trees and stolen milk bottles and bikes and magistrates' courts and all the kind of stuff that you do. And then one evening, out of the blue, I was having a drink in the local pub called the Wigan Mitre with a couple of people who worked at the radio station that had just opened a few months earlier. And they said there's a vacancy coming up.
Good morning to you on the birthday of BBC Radio Lincolnshire. I've got two very good neighbours here in Lincoln. The very young one is Radio Lincolnshire, our brand new BBC local radio station.
I knew that actually Radio Devon, it was the time of expansion for BBC local radio, and I knew that Radio Devon was opening, and I'd been born in Devon, had some kind of, you know, umbilical cord to it, a tenuous one, but a little bit anyway. And I quite fancied going down there. I thought, oh, let's go to Devon, that'd be great, down by the seaside. And I thought I'd apply for this job at Radio Lincolnshire because there was no way I was ever going to get it. But the experience of a BBC interview would stand me in good stead to get the job at Devon. And of course, then the whole plan got scuppered because I got offered the job and I had to take it because of bird in the hand. But I had the most brilliant 4 years at Radio Lincolnshire. I mean, and the fun, you know, from reporting through to doing the breakfast show and all points in between. I actually do think, I mean, I don't know what local radio is like these days. And I don't know if that was the golden era or whether it wasn't the golden era of local radio. But oh my goodness, what fun we had. I think doing the breakfast show on a local radio station, providing it's got an audience and you have an empathy with that audience, must be one of the greatest things to do, because you just wake up in the morning and, I mean, the more competent you become, the more freewheeling you tend to get as well, and you turn up at 6:05 and think, well, we'll just see how it goes. But the fact that you literally come off air and at lunchtime, if you went to the pub or in the evening, the people who you were broadcasting to were just there giving you that instant feedback was just, I think that's almost the most rewarding thing of all, because that absolute warmth, sometimes venom, mind you, that you do encounter occasionally if you'd said something stupid. I got into all sorts of trouble with a synchronised swimming team once upon a time, and my punishment for which ended up being having to go and train with them for about 3 months. And that was that told me to mind my P's and Q's a bit.
Lincolnshire's somewhere special, a special place to live and feel at home. You'll hear our voice on busy market days,
across the fields with the plowing.
I just loved that fact that 9:00, have a good day, see you tomorrow morning, and people instantly saying to you, wherever you were, you know, in the queue at the supermarket, filling the car up with petrol. I heard that bit, I heard this, I heard that. We actually did one fantastic thing. We called it the Milkman of the Year. Most milkmen in those days were men, but, you know, the Milk Person of the Year. And we ended up getting a cow into the studios, and the cow, of course, then did what cows do. I mean, health and safety, no way would you ever have been allowed to do that now. I always remember the election in 83, actually. And another lesson learned about manipulation, maybe, by a politician, but at the same time, practicality of life. Anybody who's listening to this, who's ever done a late shift on a local radio station, will know that they can be absolute pains in the arse, and they can go into the early hours in the morning, and you get very, very tired and very, very jaundiced sometimes. And I got sent out to interview Tony Benn, who was campaigning in 83 at the local sixth form college. And I introduced myself to him after he'd done his spiel. And I said, I'm from the local radio station. He said, oh, you're wanting a piece for the breakfast show tomorrow morning, aren't you? I said, yeah. He said, you probably want 2 minutes 45 for the breakfast show and 20 seconds for the news. Is that right? I said, yeah. He said, I'll give you that. And I had that sort of dilemma, that dichotomy about, was I going to be all journalistically integrity-based, or was I going to say for practical purposes, look, just do it, give me what I want, and I might get an early night for once. So I said, yeah, that'd be great. So he literally got a stopwatch out. We did the interview. I would always say that I could have asked him anything and he'd give him the same answers anyway. So he got the stopwatch out. He did 2 minutes 47 or whatever it was. Said, that's all right, isn't it? And I said, yeah, that's fine. He said, here's the piece for the news. Did me 20 seconds. Thank you very much. Back to the office. Top and tail. Stick it in the tray. Done. Home by 11. Thank you very much, Tony Benn. Now, does that matter? I mean, a lot of people would say, yes, it does matter. But sometimes you say, hey, what the heck?
Most of our people up and down the country, they're astounded at the difference in the attitude and the response that they think they're getting from what the polls say. So we'll have to wait to see about that.
One of the interesting things, and I do think it's still the same now, actually, is that on local radio, if you understand who's listening, you'll be okay. But if you try and broadcast to your peers, age-wise, you're making a mistake. And I think, certainly when I started out, I was thinking that everybody who was listening was 28, 29, 30. And they weren't. They were 55 and 60. And they weren't quite seeing the world in the way that I was seeing it, not just musically, but in terms of attitude, in terms of questioning of people. And I think only after a few conversations with actually a few people who were veterans at my rugby club, who listened out of a sense of loyalty, but also were very, very fierce critics. And they would say to me, you know that interview you did with that guy, whoever it might have been, you know, you missed the point, because for people of our age, i.e. 55, 60, whatever it was, that matters. And you were kind of trivialising it when you shouldn't have been doing that. Always think about the people who are listening. You know, you're not broadcasting to yourself. You're broadcasting for the audience, whatever that audience might be. The people that do matter are not your superiors. You're not broadcasting to the management. You're broadcasting to the guy and the girl on the garage forecourt and in the supermarket and wherever it might be who are listening. Are they all in the car? A lot are in the car. If they are in a car, are they fed up? Yes, a lot of them are fed up because they're stuck in a traffic jam. And that's why, if you're not very engaging and entertaining, the easiest thing to do in a car is to hit boom and go to someone else. So you've got to keep the energy up and you've got to keep the vitality up and the interest level up. Even when you're talking to whoever it might be about whatever it might be, who is that person in the back of your head who is listening on the M6 or the M4 or the M2 or whatever M it might be? I've been at Radio Lincolnshire for several years and it was time to move on because I wanted to move on. And the BBC has this, or I assume it still does have actually, but it still used to have anyway, this secondment programme where you could get 4 or 6 month attachments on certain things. And I got one on the Today programme on Radio 4. And that was the first time actually I really was aware of the enormity of the industry and was very intimidated as well, working on the Today programme with some of the greats, to me, of broadcasting. I mean, Jack DeManio I had grown up listening to intermittently on Radio 4.
But from the Today studio at just about 15 minutes... I can't read your writing. I've got a chap writing it out for me here, the silly fool, and I can't read his writing. Well, it's 16 minutes to and a half.
I was a Radio 4, Radio 1 listener from a very early age, and it's impossible. I mean, it really is impossible to exaggerate the difference that Radio 1 made to our lives as young people. When that came on air, it was seismic. It was absolutely... Tony Blackburn through to Noel Edmonds and all that generation of broadcasters changed us as people.
Number 15 this week in the Fun 30 from Radio 1. It's called Massachusetts, and of course it comes from the Bee Gees. I'll tell you what, I want you particularly to look upon the show as your own. If you've got anybody you want to say hello to before you go to work in the morning, then this is all you have to do. Very, very simple. Just write to Tony Blackburn, P.O. Box 1AA. Have you got that?
And I loved Radio 1 with a passion. I could recite the schedules from when the Breakfast Show came on till Pete Drummond doing The Sequence, which was just a programme where he ran loads of records back-to-back on a Friday night. And programmes like Seen and Heard with Johnny Moran, which was all the news in the music industry.
unmissable, because when you got to school the next day, did you hear that interview with Mark Bolan? Did you hear this? It was essential listening.
Time on Radio 1 is 3 o'clock. Hello, everybody, this is Johnny Moran. And a very warm welcome to you on this particular occasion, at this particular time. We're starting off a whole new series of shows.
Noel Edmonds on a Sunday morning, with all his bits and bobs and his little sort of soap operas that used to run through that programme. Again, we used to talk about them all the time.
Oh, that is so very nice. From the album Love Revisited, Love and Alone Again, and it's made a really romantic mood in here, I'm quite sure. What? Hang on, we don't have a telephone in here. Where's the telephone in here? Could you answer that for me, Jim?
Okay, I'm loosening up now.
So I loved that. I loved Radio 4 as well. Jack DiMaggio was the sort of main person on the Today programme. But then when I went to Radio 4, Brian Redhead, who was just an absolute icon for me, he was no-nonsense, a no-nonsense Mancunian, but he had great wit as well. And he used to do Today with a guy called John Timpson.
Do you think we should have a one-minute silence now in this interview? One, for you to apologise for daring to suggest that you know how I vote, and secondly, perhaps in memory of monetarism, which you've now discarded.
And sitting in the same studio as them, which I did sort of at the age of 29, I remember sitting there thinking, oh my God, how on earth have I landed here? And I was really, I was clutching on. I do remember doing sports desks and doing other bits and bobs, and having to hold tight to the desk and hoping they wouldn't see that, because I was so scared I was going to, you know, say something really stupid. The thing about when you work with somebody that good, it elevates you, because you have to. If you play golf with someone who's rubbish, you'll play badly. If you play golf with someone who's good, you will play better, because you have to. And that was how I felt with someone like Brian. He was immense.
Now, you've got a very tricky one to hang on to. Was he a majority last time?
279.
Have you been to see them all personally and shaken their hands?
I think I've seen rather a lot of them.
But, election time. I was doing the sport on Radio 4. Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister. And on the Wednesday, before the election, they always have the reigning occupant of number 10 in the studio to talk about how they think the things are going to go the next day. So I'm sitting there next door to Margaret Thatcher, and she does her interview and says thank you very much. And I think it was Brian Redhead said, well, the people will decide tomorrow. And she said, yes, Brian, indeed they will. And then it's me. But she didn't leave. So I'm sitting there doing all this slightly trivial sporting stuff, and she's just peering over me with these kind of hawk-like eyes baring into the back of my head. And all I'm thinking is, look, will you just shove off? Please go away. You're putting me off. You're the Prime Minister. I'm giving the racing tips on Radio 4. This is not important. Go, please go. But she didn't. And I finished my thing, and they did whatever they did, and she just patted me on the back of the shoulder and said, well done, very well done.
Good morning.
Would you accept, Mrs. Thatcher, that you, as much as anything, more than anything perhaps, have become the issue in this campaign?
No, I don't think so.
There was a period I was trying to ride two horses, doing an early shift on Radio 2 from 5 till 1, and then doing a late shift on Radio 4 from 3 till 11, doing a news shift. And I don't know how I did that for 9 months, because it was exhausting. I was absolutely exhausted. But I did have one experience that actually, in hindsight, was beneficial, because even though at the time it drove me around the bend, it actually got me off that hamster wheel. And I was working for the Today programme, and at a 3 o'clock meeting about what was going to happen that day and where we were going to go and what the programme was going to sound like the next day. And there was some education dispute that was happening at the time, and the school that was at the centre of it was in Diss or somewhere around there in Norfolk, and they asked for somebody to volunteer to go up there and do this piece. And I said, I'll go, always on the basis that if you actually volunteered for something and then you wanted something back a bit later on, they'd say, oh, well, he was a good chap. He went all the way to Diss. We'll let him have Thursday afternoon off or whatever. So I went to Diss having no idea how far away it was. And the evening went on forever. And I left at about 10:15 and had to drive back into London and got back at 1:30. And then you've got to put this thing together and you're topping and tailing and chopping and changing and trying to put together a 3.5-minute package that's entertaining but also covers the main issues of the agenda and blah, 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 blah. And I finished it at about 6 o'clock in the morning, just as Today was starting. And I looked at the running order, and it was down for 8:40. I remember it so vividly. It was down for 8:40. I thought, well, I'll get home, have some breakfast, I'll listen to my piece go out, and then I'll go to bed. And, of course, I waited, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited, and it got to 9 o'clock, and thank you for listening, and goodbye, see you tomorrow morning. I thought, damn it, they've dropped my piece. I've spent a day and a night of my life on this 3.5 minutes of obviously brilliantly crafted radio, and the bastards have dropped it. And I thought, well, actually, do you know, I don't want to do that anymore. I really don't. I'd rather do live stuff when you are in control of it yourself and it either works or it doesn't. And if you're on, you're on, and if you're not, you're not. So actually, that was a key moment, really, because I stopped accepting afternoon shifts thereafter, and that was a wise call. So we get to 1988, and I had a big decision to make because I still enjoyed playing rugby at the weekend, and I didn't really want to commit myself to losing that Saturday or Sunday sporting experience, but I was of a certain age and you had to make that decision. And so I auditioned for Sport on 2, as it was then, on Radio 2, got that, and almost out of the blue, I get offered the chance to go to the Seoul Olympics to be one of the front people for BBC Radio's coverage. Went off to Seoul, and that kind of set me on the path for everything that followed subsequently. And Seoul was an amazing experience to be there at the heart of the Ben Johnson drug scandal. That was the first time at a really big melee of the international media that I got that buzz, that sense of excitement about, wow, this is an incredible industry to be involved in. If you're there, when it happens, and you're right there in the middle of it, the energy that you derive from that is extraordinary.
The IOC Medical Commission recommends the following sanction: disqualification of this competitor from the games of the 24th Olympiad in Seoul.
12 months later, at the diametrically opposite end of the scale, you know, you're broadcasting live as Hillsborough is unfolding, and then you also are aware of the power of radio, the importance of radio in conveying information, and also how absolutely essential it is for you to get the tone right and to have the right words. And it's on occasions like that that people can get found out. If you haven't got the ability to come up with suitable words that have the right timbre and the right texture, the right tone, it can sound very, very crass, I think. You've got to have the words so that when things go wrong, you know how to respond. And when I look at Peter Jones's commentary, it wasn't so much a commentary, actually. It was almost a eulogy about what happened at Hillsborough that day. If anybody aspires to be a great broadcaster, just listen to Peter Jones's 58 seconds or whatever it was at the end of Sport on 2 that day, when he describes the scene of devastation and absolute tragedy at Hillsborough. Just listen to that and say, could I do that? Have I got the empathy with the occasion and then the ability with the vocabulary at my disposal? Have I got the ability to do something like that? And if the answer to that's no, it's either you're in the wrong job or it's go away and read a bit more and actually broaden that vocabulary. Because the interesting thing about Peter was, you know, he was a Welshman. He loved words. You'd never see Peter reading a sports book. You know, he'd be reading Dylan Thomas or something. And sometimes you'd think, oh, Peter, you know, for heaven's sake. But of course, at moments like that, it came into its own. It really, really did. And there are very, very few people, I think, who could have done that like he did it.
Well, I think the biggest irony is that the sun is shining now and Hillsborough's quiet, and over there to the left, the green Yorkshire hills. And who would have known that 74 people would die here in the stadium this afternoon? I don't necessarily want to reflect on Heysel, but I was there that night broadcasting with Emlyn Hughes, and he was sitting behind me this afternoon. And after half an hour of watching stretchers going out and oxygen cylinders being brought in and ambulance sirens screaming, he touched me on the shoulder and he said, I can't take any more. And Emlyn Hughes left.
I think when you're covering live action, it could be politics, but when you're covering live sport, it's very easy to just go to the draw and pull out amazing, unbelievable, who'd have thought? And that's fine. And if that's the limit of your ambitions, then you will make a very good career and you'll be absolutely fine. But if you're aspiring to be better, you know, if you are looking in a venue at the people who are the best in the world, why would you not want to be the best at what you're doing? They are setting the bar higher and higher and higher. Why aren't you? So saying amazing, unbelievable is setting the bar very low. So what else could you say in that situation? I got a lot of flack in 2012 when Mo Farah won his second gold medal on Super Saturday because we had a camera in the studio and Denise Lewis and Michael Johnson and everybody else were standing up and going, go Mo, go Mo. But I was watching Mo Farah come hurtling down that stretch at the end of one of the most extraordinary days in the history of British sport. And I was thinking, OK, Mo, you've done your bit. I've got to do my bit in 30 seconds' time, and it had better be good, because this has been such a remarkable day for British sport ever. If you say something crass or just, you know, third tier, then you haven't done your job. You haven't risen to the occasion, which is what the whole day had demanded. So I was sitting there, and I got a lot of criticism for, why weren't you engaged? Why weren't you cheering Mo on? My job was not to run through that tape. My job was when they said back to the studio, I said something good. And I actually can't remember what I did say, but all I know was, as I said it, I thought, that's all right, that'll do. That's plenty good enough. Whereas if it had been rubbish, I'd have been livid with myself. And my job was to sit in that chair, and I thought, you've got 25 seconds or so to come up with something that fits the bill. And if you don't, you haven't done your job today. This is the moment. This is the moment you've got to do, verbally, what Mo's just done physically. And that's kind of how I feel our industry always needs to be. Always raising the bar, always trying to be as good as the great broadcasters who've gone before.
If you're 50 years old, 50, I repeat, 5-0, sitting on the sofa at home, thinking, oh, well, I'll have another glass of Pinot Grigio, you should be here competing as Raoul Bradstock is at the age of 50 and finishing second in the javelin.
The old cliche about the best ad-libs are the ones you thought of earlier are very, very true. I would never script anything, but I'd write a word down, just a word. In the event of X happening, which would be truly remarkable, have you got a synonym for remarkable? You know, have you got something else? And I have to say, I'd like to thank Mr. Google immensely here, because as the years have gone by, you do cheat. But you can Google synonym extraordinary, and some great words come up, and you think, yeah, of course, how much better is that word? So just write them down a couple of times. I do think words are important because it's all we've got, let's face it. We haven't got television, we haven't got pictures. So all you've got are the voice and the words. And when you have the words, try and make the words as good as you can be. But that doesn't mean it all has to come from you, because we are all magpies and we steal from each other all the time. That requires you to listen to a lot of radio. You know, if you're a music DJ, I think you should listen to a lot of speech radio, because you'll pick up a lot of stuff that will help you in your modus operandi, and vice versa as well. If you're a desperately serious Radio 4 presenter doing the moral maze, you can still learn an awful lot from somebody on a local commercial station in the way they deliver things and the way that they create a relationship with their audience. You know, we can all learn from each other and we can all steal bits and bobs. I mean, I do remember listening to Radio Jackie, which is a local independent station near where I live, on the morning of the Federer and Nadal final. And Cesc Fabregas was playing football for Spain in the European Championship at the time. And he said, wasn't Fabregas fabulous last night? I thought, I really like that. I really like that alliteration. I just stole that away. And then, of course, Nadal wins. And I'm doing a TV programme that night. And Spain have won the European Football Championship. And I finish by saying, and Rafael Nadal, fabulous like Fabregas. Good night. And I walk back into the office. And two or three people say to me, mate, that, what a brilliant line. What an absolutely brilliant line. I went, yeah, wasn't it? Yeah.
The BBC is to launch a radio news and sports network next April on the medium wave frequencies used by Radio 5. The decision means the end of plans to begin a news-only service on Radio 4's long wave frequency.
Radio 5 was just bonkers. It was a bonkers radio station created by people who, I think, had gone bonkers at that time at the top of the BBC. Pig's ear of all radio stations. I mean, whoever had the idea that you could throw in children's series, alongside Johnny Walker, alongside the genius of Danny Baker at breakfast.
We'll do that. There's another subject to add to it. Apart from any listeners got bare feet at the moment, anyone wearing any kind of food or food stain currently, we want to hear about that. The most northerly, easterly, westerly. Score plays, we're still casting Oliver. If you think you should be a character in our Oliver, and I'll write a little script before Christmas, you can drop your lines.
Random programmes. I used to do a show in the afternoon called A Game of Two Halves with Francis Edmonds. And we've laughed about this over the years. It was awful. I mean, it really was. So there was this absolute mishmash of a radio station that had been created on the altar of, I'm not quite sure what, by people who really didn't understand radio. I don't think the hierarchy of the BBC at that time really understood radio. They didn't have it at their heart.
It's going to be a network that aims to report the UK to itself, to focus on the issues that concern its listeners. It will have a very clear philosophy.
And so you had music programmes backed up with something called the Poddington Peas. You'd have the racing results, so gambling, followed by the Poddington Peas. I finished doing the racing results, and the 5:20 at Newmarket, number one, number three, 130. And that's it from the BBC Sports Room. Now it's time for the Poddington Peas. And you'd hear the first 10 seconds, and you would go, what the?
A day in the life of the Poddington Peas.
Good morning. I'm Loopy!
When you look back on the happiest times in your life, professionally, doing the Drive Time show on Radio 5, which was the most fun ever.
John Inverdale's Drive-In, between 4 and 6.30 every weekday, will have the best star interviews, sports news as it happens, plus features, competitions, and a racing roundup.
And just when it was starting to get a sense of identity, and just when it was getting a bit of traction amongst the general public, instead of putting a medal round its neck, they put a noose round its neck, and that was the end of Radio 5.
These transmitters are now closing down for the night, but from 5 o'clock in the morning, this frequency will carry the new news and sport network, Radio 5 Live. Morning Report with Jane Garvey will be followed at 6 by the breakfast programme presented by Peter Allen. But for now, it's good night.
Enter Radio 5 Live. And I did the Drive Time show on that, taking the elements of what the old Drive Time show had been like on Radio 5, a bit of news, but essentially an entertainment programme with music, taking that into a news environment, which nobody'd done before. And people kept saying, this is truly extraordinary, what you're doing on this programme. I mean, no, it's not. It's not extraordinary. It's just treating council tax changes in the same way as you would talking to somebody about horse racing or introducing a record by the Doobie Brothers. Why is it different? It's just a different topic, but you just do the same thing. And obviously, bit by bit, a lot of people thought, actually, yes, this is not reinventing the wheel at all. It really isn't. It's just doing speech radio in a way that it's much more accessible, much more enjoyable, and most important of all, it means you can tolerate it for 24 hours a day, because otherwise, if you've got presenters who are sitting there for 24 hours a day reading cues endlessly, and it's bland and monotone, you sure as heck are going to be searching for that dial and going elsewhere. I always think there are two ways of doing a story or doing radio. You can either say, it's just plucking out of thin air. 10 years ago today, the London Olympics began. And wasn't it a marvellous opening ceremony, and James Bond and the Queen, and who will ever forget, blah, 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 blah. You can do it like that. You're just reading the cue that somebody has written for you. Or you can say, can you believe it? I mean, can you really believe it? It's 10 years ago today. 10 years ago today. I mean, how excited were we? I mean, I got a big screen television, specially for the occasion, and it was ridiculous. It was half the size of the sitting room. Anyway, we got this massive tea. We all sat down, got a bottle of this, and the opening ceremony. Oh, my God, Danny Boyle, Queen. But how much more interesting is that? If you're listening to that, you go, yeah, I remember that. I was there. I got a big screen TV. I got a bottle of wine. Whatever it might be, you're together. The whole thing about radio is it's a we thing. It's you are 50% of it, because you're doing the talking, and everybody else is 50%, and they're doing the listening. And it's a we thing. I mean, if I have absolutely pet bugbears about radio, my guest today is... No, it's not your guest, it's our guest. You know, I will be talking. Well, obviously you're going to be talking, because you're doing the damn programme. So don't tell me that. You know, we will be talking. Later on, our guests are. It's a shared experience between the broadcaster and the listener.
I think the best phone call we had was the guy, if anyone who missed it was actually the last phone call we had about 4 weeks ago at sort of 6:33. And this guy rang in saying that he and his wife had played pub cricket for years. For people who don't know about this, Danny will give you a quick resume of what pub cricket is.
Producers and editors, you know, have to do their job, but I always have felt that the one thing that the good producers understand is that actually the only person who ever listens to the programme in its entirety from moment one to moment 101 is the presenter. Because they can't do that, because they've got other things to do. There are guests to get up, there are phone calls to answer, there are issues with bits of tape in the old days, whatever it might be, digital stuff now. There's always other things to do if you're producing. You are not listening in isolation. You are not listening to the programme in the way that the listener is. So you have to trust the presenter. And if they cut an interview short because it's boring, and they say, why did you cut that short? You don't need to say, because it was dull as whatever. Just trust me. It was down on the running order for 4 minutes, and we only gave it two, because after two, I could just hear. Because if you're presenting, you can hear it. You can hear this cacophony of noise from Carlisle to Cornwall as people are looking for something more interesting to listen to. So trust me on that. And conversely, if an interview is down for 4 minutes and it is amazing, trust me to keep it going. Because it's not in any of our interests for people to be switching off. But I'm listening to the programme and I'm listening to the interview. And let it run. And I will never forget John Mayall, the great blues guitarist, one of the founding fathers of the British blues movement and one of the most influential people in British music in the last sort of 50, 60 years, who was a bit curmudgeonly a lot of his life, but, you know, he came into the studio to, I think he was just to publicise a new album anyway, and he was up for chatting. And he was down on the running order at 16 minutes past six. It's funny how you remember little things like this, because I suppose maybe they still niggle away at you, I don't know. He was down to run at 16 minutes past six until about 20 past. And at 20 past, he was in full flow, and I was thinking, this is going all the way to 6:30 news and beyond if needs be, because this is radio gold. And at this point, you've got somebody in your ear saying, right, wrap him up, and you just say, and you actually, on occasions, you just take your headphones off. Because also, mate, what are you going to do about it? I am in control of this ship. I've got the tiller in my hand, and you can tell me to shut up as much as you want, but I know on this occasion that people listening are loving this. They are loving this. So don't frustrate them by midway through cutting him off when everybody's like, oh God, I want you to hear more of that, to go to the proverbial skateboarding duck or whatever it might be. So that interview ran through until I think it was 34, 35. I almost did 20 minutes with him, which in the context of a programme where every item was 3 minutes, because that was the point of it, keep it moving, you know, completely changed the kilter of the programme. But it was fantastic. Anyway, 1 minute past seven, we have a full and frank discussion about this. And I say, listen, 99% of the time, I'll go with the flow. I'll say yes. But just sometimes you've just got to trust the presenter. Anyway, we had words. I went off in a very bad mood, drove home. I was really irritated. And I stopped at a pub to have a beer to calm myself down before I got home. And a guy just walked up to me at the bar, out of the blue, and said, I just want to say, I stayed and sat in my car all the way through until the end of that interview with John Mayall, because it was just amazing, wasn't it? And I said, thank you so much.
Well, the first Cheltenham Gold Cup was run exactly 200 years ago, and it was a flat race on Cleve Hill, the magnificent backdrop to Britain's greatest racecourse. And if you were standing up there right now, you'd look down on a sight that 19th century racegoers would...
People say so often, you are so lucky, you've got the most amazing job, and they're absolutely right, because you do have the best seat in the house at some extraordinary events.
The Ryder Cup on 5 Live
with John Inverdale.
Well, good morning from me, John Inverdale, and all our team here in County Kildare in Ireland.
Welcome from all the 5 Live team that are scattered around this Valhalla golf course. We have just the 11 hours of non-stop talking for you today.
Welcome to Glen Eagles from me, John Inverdale, and the 5 Live team.
Welcome to Michigan, to Detroit.
Welcome to the 39th Ryder Cup at the Medina Country Club.
9 o'clock on a rather spooky, eerie Monday morning at Celtic Manor.
This is the most compelling of all the open venues. If you've never seen pictures of Turnberry, then please, please, please watch at some stage.
I cannot tell you what a fantastic morning we've got here at Lytham.
So here we are at Sandridge, and it's horrible here.
It's just horrible.
For me, the Rugby World Cup in 1995, the famous picture of Mandela and Francois Pienaar, and I was standing 100 yards away or so from that. That was one of those moments when you almost have to just say, remember that kid? And you'd say, if you'd ever said to him that you would be in a situation like this, you'd have said, oh, don't be so silly.
We will unite the country. And that victory over the All Blacks will make their achievement even more significant.
If I was to do a top 10 list of events you've been at, you'd say, God, you lucky so-and-so. You've actually been to all those? And I think, and that's through radio. But then the key responsibility you've got then is to remember how you felt when you listened to events 20, 30, 40 years ago, and to try and convey that excitement and that energy and the enormity of what you're watching to the people who are now watching. That's your job, to bring it into their lives and to make them, almost to make them jealous, actually, to make them think, I would love to be there. I would love to be there sitting next door to you and feeling and sensing and experiencing that.
A hospitality village so large it almost has its own postcode. A battalion of helicopters ferrying in the great, the good and the not so good. Grandstands packed like tube trains, and in the middle of all this...
It's interesting because even doing television for 30-odd years, people don't tend to come up to you and say, I remember that moment, blah. Because television and the people who perform on television don't have quite that same empathy that the radio listener does with the radio broadcaster. But there is one incident at the Olympics in 2012 when Zach Purchase and Mark Hunter got the silver medal in the rowing when they really, everyone thought they were going to win as they had done in Beijing 4 years earlier. And the sense of loss, almost bereavement, that they expressed live on television, to me, and I'd sort of been on their journey with them in a similar, in a very, very small way because I'd followed them the whole way and had known them for years and all that sort of stuff, to see that sense of devastation in their faces, I lost it. I mean, I really did lose it. And it was the first time I'd ever experienced of whatever you do, don't cry. And funnily enough, I think if I had cried, it might have been better because crying wasn't cool then. I could have started a trend, but I just desperately, whatever you do, don't, they're crying, don't you cry as well. But I did, there was a lump in my throat, and it was a very inarticulate piece of broadcasting afterwards, because the emotion was that raw, but very, very real.
But thank you so much for all the help you've given us over the last few years, and, you know, you're silver medalists, guys, you know.
Sorry, once again.
Okay, cheers, listen, take care. Steve will take them down towards the medal ceremony where they'll receive their silver medals. emotions, goodness me. Just especially when you know these people and you know them pretty well. It's quite hard being here as well. Right, let's one more race to go. And it's the women's single sculls. And talk about longevity. Steve's, the living example.
When you listen to radio, it's always very easy just to listen to one radio station. And the danger of that, of course, is that you just get very... It doesn't become broadcasting, it becomes narrowcasting. And the great thing about broadcasting is you've got John Humphreys at one end and you've got Sarah Cox at the other. That's not in terms of ability, that's in terms of brilliance. You know, they're both brilliant with a capital B, but they do it... Their brilliance is different. Their stars shine in different ways. And so when you talk about great broadcasters, I think about people like Robert Robinson, who, doing Stop the Week in days gone by on Radio 4, peerless, absolutely magnificent.
I think really, of all awful public noises, I think the worst is the mindless, inarticulate hooting, ribald hooting that goes up from a builder's scaffolding when any female under the age of 60 walks by.
Danny Baker. When Danny Baker is on song, he is Celtic United all rolled into one. He really is. Chris Evans, the way that Chris, over so many years, has maintained his enthusiasm and his drive and his, you know, turbocharged energy on air is an example to all of us. And we used to, in the days when I used to do Sport on 2 and Sport on 5, we used to have a production meeting at 10 o'clock in the morning. But I never went to it because Chris Evans used to do on a station called GLR again, which is another radio station that should never have been cut off in its prime because it was great.
It's April the 3rd, 1993. Something special happening today? FA Cup semi-final
Grand National.
Something else?
That was last week.
Christmas? No, simple time.
Easter?
No, too early for that. That's next weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Grand Prix?
No, that's next weekend.
Sponsored by Sega?
That's next weekend.
All right, okay. No.
He used to do a thing called The Kids Are All Right, Even If They're Wrong, at 10:15. And I knew if I listened to that, it would make me so happy and so upbeat that I couldn't wait to get in the ring, effectively, and broadcast myself, because it was so brilliant. So I always used to say, there's no point in having the production meeting at 10 if you want me to be there. I'll be there at 25 past, and I will be so much better on air on Saturday afternoon by virtue of having heard Chris do that, because it was that brilliant. And equally, years later, Jonathan Ross, when he was in his pomp doing his show on a Saturday morning on Radio 2, and I was always doing rugby matches for BBC television and whatnot, I'd say, I'm sorry, there is no filming between 10 and 10:45, because that's when Jonathan would offer his spiel on the world that was so funny and so brilliant and so impromptu, but yet so brilliantly crafted, that he would make me want to broadcast. I was almost like I had to be held back. I want you to go and broadcast now, because that was so good, and I've got to try and be anything like as good as that. And when you hear people who are that good, it does have that effect on you. Whereas, of course, conversely, when you hear people who are average, it sucks the energy out of you.
We have two nuts, and I have a hammer, and they've given me safety goggles. Apparently, there's BBC requirements. Even here at the last minute, we just said, let's smash open the nut. They went out and got me safety goggles. How's that for your licence-paying money at work, eh? Yeah.
I think it is a matter of luck if you get a voice that is a great radio voice. It has to cut through. And it doesn't matter if you've got the broadest Geordie accent or whatever you've got. It's just got to somehow... I don't understand how radio works, but I genuinely don't understand how it is that somehow one voice works and one voice palpably doesn't. It's desperately unfair. It is just how the dice have fallen.
It changes places with this one. From the Ark of a Diver LP, which is number 4 in the LP chart, Steve Winwood's While You See a Chance.
But somebody like Gambaccini's voice just cuts through the ether. It's about pitch or timbre or tone or whatever it is. I don't really understand what it is. Say, like John Peel.
Life itself is contrived and meaningless.
In a lugubrious, downbeat voice. And yet, that cuts through in the same way as Chris Evans's voice, which is a constant, completely different pitch. And has a heaven knows how many octaves difference there is between them. So there's no hard and fast rule about it. It's just that some voices work on radio and some don't. And especially if you're doing long programmes, it's got to be a voice that cuts through. Because a long spiel with a voice that really doesn't have it, whatever that magical it is a very hard listen. There are certain moments in your career, especially if you've had a long one, where you're bound to get into hot water. And the Wimbledon Ladies Singles Final 2013, Marion Bartley against Sabine Lisicki, as a match which wouldn't normally live in the mind, kind of is always foremost in mind when I think about my broadcasting career, because I found myself in the most appalling situation whereby I was trying to talk. I mean, I really was trying to do something that was enormously positive about Marion and saying what a great player she was and her determination and her resolution was without equal, and that's why she became a Grand Slam champion. But I got into all sorts of a twizzle and saying that her dad... And it's one of these also interesting things that when you do broadcast, you have to make split seconds decisions about what to say and how to say it. And I was going to say, and I remember this so vividly, I was going to say her father would have said to her, you're never going to have the physical attributes of Serena Williams or Maria Sharapova, because she's, you know, physically different, she's a different shape, hasn't got long arms, can't reach the ball in the same way, so you've got to play the game differently. I was going to say that, and I thought, no, that's going to offend somebody, don't say that. So, of course, I ended up saying something much more offensive, saying that her dad said that you're never going to be a looker, which is not what I meant at all, but I knew what I was trying to say, but I just didn't say it very well.
Well, I just wonder if her dad, because obviously he's been the most influential person in her life, I just wonder if her dad did say to her when she was 12, 13, 14 maybe...
The mistake I made as well, apart from saying it in the first place, was I didn't apologise instantly. That's what I learnt very swiftly afterwards, But I think I was from a generation brought up on the never apologise, never explain, on the basis that people listening would think, didn't really say that, did he? So you moved on, and I'm sure, you know, the great broadcasters of the past got away with heaven knows what, because there was no means of actually going back to an iPlayer or whatever and hearing it back. So you just assumed that you must have misheard it. So there was a legacy of that. And also, I just didn't quite know how to apologise. And I think that would have deflated a huge amount of the furore that subsequently followed. But I didn't, because I wasn't quite sure what to do. I apologised to Marion personally, and she said, fine, don't worry about it. I mean, she's just become Wimbledon champion. Why would she care? And she and I have worked together for years subsequently, you know, and it's an irrelevance. But I should have apologised instantly. I didn't. And so, as a consequence of that, it gathered pace to the point where, you know, there are questions in the House of Commons and you have the press outside your front door. And it's a very dark place to be there. When you're in the eye of a media storm, whenever I read about people who don't normally find themselves in that position, suddenly cast as a major player in a... It's a very short soap opera, but it's getting big audience figures for a while. It's not much fun. It really isn't. And I was very, very down. And even though I was getting a huge amount of support from colleagues who were saying this is ridiculous, there was a period where I thought I might just jack this in. I just don't need this. This is making me so unhappy. It's not true. And it was undoubtedly the lowest point of my professional career. I really did think, that's it. By that stage, I'd been doing it for 30 years. That's probably enough. I'll go away and do something else. But then mercifully, the following week, the Open Championship was on. And that was like 10 hours a day of broadcasting. So effectively, you had 40 hours to broadcast. And I did go into that thinking, right, you've got 40 hours of broadcasting here. If you can broadcast for 40 hours, A, that's no mean feat, and if you can broadcast for 40 hours without making a single cock-up and actually being mildly good, then actually, that's pretty good too. So I was almost ticking the hours off. And once I got to the end of that golf week, I felt slightly more reassured. And I thought, actually, you can do this job, as opposed to thinking that, you know, the rug had been pulled out from underneath you and you were never going to do it again. But the lesson about apologising was well learnt, and a few months later when I had a slip of the tongue at Cheltenham Races and I meant to say rose-tinted spectacles, or I couldn't decide if I meant to say that, or rose-coloured spectacles, and I ended up getting caught in between the two, I apologised instantly. And even though people complained about it, nobody really complained about it, because it had been and it had gone in an instant. So, lessons learned. You're always learning. You know, never think that you know it all, because you sure don't.
I apologise there for a slip of the tongue. But Lizzie, your love of the sport just shines.
There is undoubtedly a danger that if you do the same thing over and over again, you can actually start boring yourself. And if you are bored of yourself and what you're saying, you can bet as sure as eggs is eggs that the people listening are getting bored with it. So I made the decision to stop doing Five Live and to stop doing the Cheltenham Festival, which is something I've loved all my life and will continue to love, but I'll go as a spectator instead. Because I was starting to think I was just sounding like a record that had got stuck. I was saying the same thing year after year after year. And that's what you mustn't do. You've got to bring something new. You've got to take people with you, but you've also got to inject a new perspective. And I felt I'd sort of stopped doing that, so it was the right time to stop. So it was with a heavy heart, but it was also knowing that it was the right thing to do, and I don't have any regrets about it at all.
It's down to the Americans to see if they can conjure a bit of magic from the sand and the rough just to the right-hand side of the green. Are you in the toilet?
I was in a bit of on the horns of a moral dilemma, you might say, there, because I had nipped into one of the toilets down beside the 18th, and I thought, how long is Russell's link going to be here? On health and safety grounds, should I flush the toilet, or should I just pretend not to and just keep walking? And in the end, mercifully, the fader got was opened at just the wrong moment, and so anyway.
Even if you've metaphorically hung up the microphone for the moment from a radio point of view, and I'm still doing all the television stuff, you don't ever leave radio. Radio never leaves you, I don't think, because when you wake up in the morning, I always put the radio on. I've never watched breakfast television in my life. Why would you watch television in the morning? Why, you know, there's things to get. You've got to get on with living, and that's where radio is so important. So I do think that Nick Robinson on the Today programme is excellent, and Zoe's doing a good job on Radio 2. Hard gig to follow such behemoths of the industry, but she's really, really good. Sarah Cox in the evening driving home is just fantastic.
But equally, you're listening as well. Critically, I still find myself being the biggest critic. How would I have done that? Would I have done that? I wouldn't have done that as well as that. That was really good. Or I would have done that better than that because I would have done that. I don't think you will ever, if you've worked in radio for as long as I've worked in radio, you can't ever not be in the industry because you're always sensing it and feeling it. I do think that about radio more than television, certainly. It becomes part of you. It's in you. And as a broadcaster as well, you hear radio in your head the whole time. When you're broadcasting live, it's almost like an out-of-body experience. You understand what the program is, and you're hearing the program in a binary kind of way. It's on two levels. There's the whole jigsaw, but there's also the individual pieces, which is what you're working on as you're actually broadcasting. And that's a funny skill to have. I wouldn't use the word talent. It's just something that you have, which I think is born of loving the medium, actually loving it. And the way that you create radio is a source of great joy. And that's why when you hear people who don't have that, you can actually hear it. You can hear it. They're doing it in a much, it's much more a functional operation rather than a labour of love.
Well, thank you very much. That is it from Cheltenham for Five Live and for this year. And it's for me after many, many years. It's been a privilege. If I thanked all the people I have to thank, then we'd be here until the next key vote at Westminster. And you don't want that. So listen.
It's really interesting wondering what radio is going to sound like in 10, 20, 30, 40 years' time. I'm staggered by the audience figures these days, because why isn't everybody just on their phone or online? But we're still listening. And I think the reason for that is the relationship element. You like an individual at a certain time of the day. I mean, I know I'm like that as well. If A.N. Other, who I really like listening to, goes on holiday for a fortnight and some random dep comes in, I'm livid. How dare you go on holiday? Don't you realise you're an integral part of my life? I have to listen to you at a certain time every day, and I don't want to listen to X. So as long as radio has that ability to engage between the broadcaster and the listener, it will stand itself in pretty good stead. Further down the road, I don't know, I mean, the change is so great in our industry at the moment, I can't even imagine what it would be like in 30, 40 years' time. Maybe we'll all have our own personal radio station in the way that, you know, on Spotify we have our own playlists, and we can almost download, everything is specifically aimed at us, what we want to hear news-wise, music-wise. We don't need somebody in between the bits, that we'll all have our own radio stations via our phone, via our wristwatch, via, you know, something you just implant in your head before you go to bed at night. But I still think as long as there's that desire and that need, actually, for the broadcaster and the listener to share the experience, radio probably will be all right. Going forward, I really don't know. In the back of my mind, I've always had this ridiculous notion of running a bar overlooking the sea, playing Steely Dan 24/7 on the in-house entertainment system, but I don't think economically that probably is a winner. But equally, if I look back to the days of listening to Noel Edmonds and all the people in those teenage years when I was really starting to engage with radio properly, intellectually, if you like.
Good, is he?
If I look back to there, and I then fast forward 30-odd years, 40 years, there's not many things I haven't done. I've been ridiculously lucky to have gone to all these great events. I would like to have worked abroad. I could have had a chance to do that in 95 after the Rugby World Cup, but Johannesburg was not the place to go at that point. It was a very dangerous place, so that ship has probably sailed. I'd love to have done the Today programme just once, just to say I'd done it on the CV. Tick, done. And equally, the same would apply to doing the Top 40 rundown. I'd love to have done that just once and made sure I didn't mess it up and I got all the numbers at the right point and the interjections in the music and all that sort of stuff. But by and large, you know, there have to be no regrets. And I think you do just hope that across the piece, when people have tuned in, they've thought, actually, I'm quite glad this guy's on because they know what they're talking about and they're going to be engaging, entertaining, and I might have a laugh. Then you've done your job. And I think if that could be my epitaph, I'd settle on that.
John Inverdale. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast.